We're doing the book of Shoftim, and we're up to the final chapters. We had learned the story of Pesel Micha, Micha who set up a house of worship. We had moved on to the story of the man and his concubine, his Pilegesh. They had a fight. We discussed what was the root of the fight. She goes off to her father. After 3 months, he comes, and his father-in-law encourages him to sit around for 3 days, and at the end, he says, time to go. And the father-in-law detains him, says, have a good meal, and then you'll go. So, he's not looking to pick fights. They sit down, they eat. And then he says, look, spend another night. And the guy says, no, let's go. And the father-in-law says, no, stick around. So, he sticks around. He gets up early the next morning. He's ready to go. And the father-in-law says, come on, wait till the sun's out and eat a bit. So, again, they eat, and he gets up to go. And the father-in-law says, look, it's getting late. Spend the night here, and then you'll feel good. Tomorrow you'll get up bright and early and go. And the guy refuses, and they travel. And they come to the city of Yerushalayim, which is conquered, which was not yet taken from the Yevusi. And he has his pack animals with food, and he has a lad. And it's getting late Friday afternoon, and the lad says, let's go to the Yevusi city. And he says, no, we're not going to a Gentile city. Let's continue. We'll travel till that hilltop over there, the hilltop of the tribe of Benjamin. They come to that hilltop. They enter the city. Everyone's rushing back and forth, and no one says a word. They have everything they need, and they're not invited home. And then an old man comes and invites them in, and they discover they come from the same territory. They both come from the mountainous regions of Ephraim, and they're sitting, and they're eating, and they're drinking, and suddenly there are knocks on the door. So as they're finishing the meal, the house is surrounded. And the gang of the city has surrounded the house. And they're banging on the door and they say, we want the man who has come to your house, we want to know him. You guys know what it means to know a person biblically. So the old man comes out and he says, brothers, don't be evil. This man came to my house, don't do such a disgraceful thing. You know, I have a daughter, he has his concubine, you want, we'll take them out, but don't do that. So they refuse to listen. So the guy inside pushes out his concubine, and the whole night long she is being tormented. And when the morning comes after they've raped her and molested her, they release her. And as the crack of dawn, the sun rises, she comes to the house and she lies there. She doesn't have strength to knock on the door. He gets up in the morning, he opens the door, and he sees her there falling and her hand is on the doorstep. Very picturesque the way the Navi describes. So he says to her, get up, we'll go. No answer. She's dead. He didn't realize it yet. He lifts her. He puts her on the donkey. And he goes back home. When he comes home, he cuts her body into 12 pieces. And sends 12 pieces to the 12 tribes. And he sends it with word about what happened. And when the people of Israel get it, each tribe gets a limb, the high court suddenly gets a special delivery. Obviously, he succeeds in stunning everyone, and they start questioning what happened. They hear what's happened, and they say, no, this never happened in Jewish history. We can't let such a thing happen. So they send word throughout Israel. They're going to gather and analyze what happened and what has to happen. Now, let's pause and analyze the story for a minute, because very often we think, this is just like Sodom and Amorah. But is it? In Sodom and Amorah, the law was a law that was illegitimate, illogical, cruel, inhumane. The law of Sodom and Amorah was such. And the people of Sodom united and came with this terrible request, demand of Lot. In our story, the people of the city didn't make any demands. You had a gang. You had a group of people. You had a bunch of gangsters who surrounded this house. It doesn't say anywhere that the people backed them. The issue we're about to face is an argument between the people of Israel and the tribe of Benjamin as to who is responsible to dealing with the story. And there's going to be a civil war around that question. But no one said that these people were okay in what they did. In Sodom and Amorah, the people backed this behavior and they were all partners to it. In Israel, that's not what happened. The pasuk clearly says, as we translated, you had derelicts, you had gangsters who showed up and surrounded the house. Okay, so there was a problematic gang. So you have, perdition's angels. Okay, so you have to deal with them. You have a problem. That doesn't say the whole society is corrupt. Now, when you read the story, you have to see within the story what's really going on here. Technically, we have no witnesses. We have no king. If we'd have a king, so then the king would come in with his soldiers and take care of the gang, because a king isn't bound by the rules that you need to have witnesses. And that's perhaps why the story begins with the verse, there was no king in Israel. Because you didn't have a central authority that could really deal with this. And this, on the contrary, this shows us the greatness of the people of Israel, that everyone was able to unite, even without a king, to come and deal with this. And all the tribes are going to unite, and there's going to be a massive civil war against the tribe of Benjamin, with the claim that you have to give over the people of the hilltop. We have to ensure that justice is served. But in truth, the tribe of Benjamin has a very strong claim. You have no witnesses. This isn't first-degree murder. It's possibly second degree, possibly third degree. Do you know who did what to the girl that caused her to die? No one knows. So you don't know. So a terrible thing happened. You want to jail them, jail them. You want to kill them? By what right? You have no proof. You have no witnesses. You have nothing. So how can you just listen to one guy who cuts up his concubine, sends her around Israel, and you're going to go and execute a bunch of people? Based on what? The fact that you're upset, we agree, we're also upset. But now, how do you call this justice? So again, a court, a king, can actually go out and say this is what has to happen. But here, who's deciding? And based on what? Based on one person's testimony. So technically, the tribe of Benjamin is in the right. And they say this is our internal affair, we have to deal with the hilltop. And the people of Israel say, no, it's a national affair. It affects all of us. If such a crime happens, we as a people are reacting.
But it was two guys.
It was a group. It was a gang.
No, but it was...
But they were in the house. The husband and the host were in the house. They didn't know what was going on outside. They had no way of seeing. They had no way of knowing who did what. And aside from that, if 10 people punch a guy in the face, and then he drops dead, are you going to give them all the death penalty? The first guy who punched him in the face, he didn't cause him to die. Neither did the second. What will you say? The 10th caused him to die. But maybe the 10th only caused him because he maybe he had no way of knowing he would cause him to die. So as cruel as the story was, and as much as there's definitely a need for justice to be served, that doesn't mean that you have a right to administer the death penalty. And that was the claim of the tribe of Benjamin. So, I think you were first, Yaakov, right? Yeah.
How is it that you could have offered the women to the mob who are so disgusting?
It's a good question. I want to make the question harsher. I don't have an answer to the question. But one thing we do find... I don't know why. Chazal viewed this man as a positive human being. As the man who pushed his concubine out the door. So you read the story and you feel like what a terrible person he was. And yet Chazal, I don't know why, said that beyond the story, the man was a pious person. And we're missing something in the story. So I don't know what we're missing. I don't know why Chazal viewed him positively. I ask the same question. Why do we say what he did was right? By what right could he do that? And even if you say he had a right to do it, how could you view such a person positively? So, I don't know. I don't have an answer.
There's a different reason.
I guess there's something else going on here, but I don't know what it is.
So what's the correlation between waiting, between the father waiting and making the wait up for days?
I didn't follow. Ah, I don't know. Don't know.
You couldn't have been...
I mean, So the Ralbag writes that one of the things this teaches us is that a host shouldn't detain a guest. Very often you say, have a drink, stay a little longer. No, he has his schedule. And sometimes it's very uncomfortable for a guest to say, I gotta go. So the Ralbag says, one of the things we should learn from this story is that when a guest says he has to go, let him go. You don't want him speeding down the highway. You don't want him going through a dangerous route because he's out of time. So part of being a good host is also recognizing when your guest has to leave and letting him leave on time. The Ralbag says that's one of the ideas we're supposed to learn from the story. But what else? I don't know. Yeah?
Could he be a good person from other things that are not revealed in the story and that's why Chazal drew him favorably?
He could be. The question is, how did Chazal know he was such a good person? Because he's always called Ha'ish. I'm saying, it seems like even in his actions, Chazal didn't view them as harshly as we do. And the question is, why? I mean, rape is considered equivalent to death. I mean, it's just like you're allowed to save a woman from being killed, you're allowed to save her from being raped. And just like you're allowed to save a woman from being killed, even if it means killing the person who's chasing after her, by the same token, you're allowed to save a woman from rape, even if you have to kill the guy chasing after her, that the Torah says. So then what's going on here? Meaning it's the equivalent of pushing his wife to the lions then.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, that was the play. Even if you did a lot of other good things, it doesn't balance something like
that. Yeah, so I don't know. I'm saying I'm missing something in the story. I don't know what I'm missing.
There's information that's not in the story.
Yeah, but the question is, how did Rav Moshe Feinstein in a response and no? Like, what was his source? How did he read the story that he walked away saying positive things about this person? I don't know. There's a tshuva of Rav Moshe where he speaks, they asked him a certain question about the story and he answers, and you see from the way he speaks about the husband, he speaks about him positively. Why? What are we misreading in the story? I don't know.
He must have been on such a high level that he could see that, otherwise surely would have explained it if people could understand it, no?
I don't know.
Why wouldn't one explain what people are capable of absorbing if that's what you do?
It's in passing. That's not the focus of his responsa. Just saying there are other sources that give us a very positive view of this person. And again, the question is, how does that work? I don't know. Yes?
Two things. One, do we know any context of why they wanted to rape somebody?
I don't know. I think that the understanding is that there was a problematic gang over there to begin with, and this was a certain culmination. This is where things actually exploded. Yeah, number two.
By what means was the guy able to cut a human body into 12 pieces and send it? It
says he took a knife. And it's interesting that it uses the same word for a knife as the Torah uses for the knife that Avram took in the Akedah. It uses the same word, ma'achelet.
I'm saying, halakhically, can you just cut open a dead body?
Halakhically, we owe a dead body respect, and we're not allowed to derive benefit from a dead body. But it could be that serving justice was the best way to respect the body, and it could be that this was Oras Shah, where he said, even though ordinarily this isn't the halacha, there's no such concept of slicing up a body that was murdered this way, but he saw that by doing this, he would ensure that the Jewish people would abolish evil from their midst. And so that, in this case, that overrode the other needs
would
of the time.
Would you say that the end results abolished evil from their midst?
Yeah. So some of the commentaries say that this man was actually the leader of the generation. It wasn't just a regular person traveling. But that, to my mind, only makes it harsher. You know. But there is such an opinion among the commentaries that this was actually the leader of the time who was caught on that hilltop. And it was him who they wanted to take out. Now, again, the question is, did they know it was him? because they don't refer to him by name. And it's interesting that even though in other contexts we do discover his name, over here the Navi doesn't say; it just says the man, Haish, Haish. You don't hear who it is. Yes.
That would explain a lot, actually. I mean, if you think about who's more important, the president or the first lady, the prime minister or his wife.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean the president can shove his wife out the door, you know.
He wasn't the wife.
Being murdered, raped, or whatever, the one who's in that kind of position, or his wife,
Okay, so there's... Some want to say that that's what he was thinking. That if a woman undergoes rape, she can walk away alive. And he didn't think she'd die from it. But he did think he would die from it. Some want to say that. Okay. I don't know.
Wasn't
his concubine, his Pelegish, yeah. Tom? Yes?
What's the relevance of people walking by him for so long when he got to the city center and just ignoring him?
Especially what do you say? What do you say? Yeah.
Well, we know. There's two answers. If he's famous or not. If he's famous, and people know him, then they don't want to be associated with him, and that's why they're walking around. Or the other answer could be that he's not famous, and that they don't have that hospitality.
So I think that even though we went the route the Ramban goes, and we stressed that. This is different than Sodom and Amorah because here it was just a gang. But nonetheless, the background where no one invites him in tells you that this gang had fertile breeding ground. Meaning this was nonetheless a city that did not have the hallmarks of descendants of Avraham Avinu of taking a person in. So the Jewish people unite all the way from the north down to the south, Be'er Sheva. And the Jews on the eastern side of the Jordan. Everyone comes together. And they come to this huge, huge piece of land called Mitzpah, which was a place like this huge coliseum where people would gather. And all the tribes are there. You have almost 500,000 people. 400,000 soldiers. And they've all come armed. And the tribe of Benjamin hears what's going on. So... they're waiting. And the Levi says, I came to the hilltop with my Pelegish. And then the masters of the hilltop, they surrounded the house at night. They wanted to kill me. And they tortured my concubine till death. And then I cut her up and I sent her out because of the disgraceful thing they did. And now we have to figure out what we're doing. And the nation said, no one's going back home until we deal with this. So they send word to the hilltop and the tribe of Benjamin disagrees. They send to the tribe of Benjamin, how did such an evil thing happen in your midst? Give over the people of the hilltop, those bums, those gangsters. We will execute them and remove evil from Israel. And the tribe of Benjamin refuses. Now they see all of Israel has united, and they stick to their guns. Now, you can understand the story on multiple levels. We already gave the legal background to what was going on here. But if you think from a political science perspective, so then there's also a question of a tribe's sovereignty as opposed to the greater people. So the tribe of Benjamin unites. And the tribe of Benjamin has 26,000 soldiers. Aside from the hilltop, which had another 700 soldiers. So they had 700 marksmen who could throw a rock from a large distance and hit a hare. From a large distance they could hit a hare. With their rock. They were so sharp, these sharp shooters. So, they ask Hashem who should lead to war, and God says Yehuda should lead. So now we have a war between Israel being led by Yehuda against Binyamin.
God's not Benjamin if God's telling him who's supposed to
let's see. They go to war, and the tribe of Benjamin comes out to meet them, and the tribe of Benjamin kills 22,000 Israelites. Am Yisrael lost the first battle. They decide, okay, we'll go back. We're going to have to attack on the same spot tomorrow. They go, they weep, they ask Hashem, should we go to war again tomorrow? And God says, go. So they go a second day and they attack and they lose another 18,000 soldiers. So now Israel has lost 40,000 soldiers. And they weep and they fast and they daven and they offer sacrifices and they ask Hashem, what are we supposed to do now? Should we go to war again against Benjamin? Maybe we should stop. And Hashem says, okay, go and tomorrow you'll win. Now, what's going on here? So the first 2 days, they didn't ask if they'd be victorious. Should we go to war? Yes, you're supposed to go to war and lose. Why were they supposed to lose? Because in heaven, Hashem was very upset at the people of Israel. Here they were uniting because they said it's beneath our dignity to have one human being treat another human being with such disgrace. And God says, how can it be that a whole tribe amongst you is serving an idol, the idol of Micha, and there no one says a word? No one thought to unite and go to war against the tribe of Dan and say, you can't have an idol in your midst. How could a tribe of Israel have an idol in their midst? No one thought to say that, right? So you can all unite because it's beneath your dignity. But for my dignity, God says, no one lifts a finger. So go to war, yeah, go. And lose. And so they went the first time, they went the second time. And Hashem was giving them a message which they didn't get, which was, you're not fit to win this war because you're going in the name of what? If you're going in my name, then you should have also gone in my name when a whole tribe erected an idol in their midst. And that's why the two stories are juxtaposed, even though technically they're not in the same time of history. But the Navi is purposely showing us why what was going on here. Now, very often people are like that. If we see someone doing something that's immoral, we blow a gut. But if it's something that's antithetical to Judaism, so he's driving a car on Shabbos. But if you see him pick up a cat and smack it, then people go wild. Wait a second, explain that to me. I'm not telling you it's right to pick up a cat and smack it, but how come when he desecrates Shabbos that doesn't bother you? LMI, there's a reason, right? Yeah. No, I'm giving you a real example, by the way. There was once a student here who took the cat that visited and threw it against the wall and stood back and laughed. So students came, they went wild. Like, how could that happen? Okay, I understand them. I'm not arguing with that. But, you know, when a student walks around smoking a cigarette on Shabbos, do people go wild? Like, okay. Yeah.
That happens. It's
different.
Sure. But it's different. Because the one is out of, you think, real ignorance, and most people know the unnecessary cruelty to an animal. You're not ignorant. The guy who's smoking on Shabbos.
A guy who walks around the Machon Meir hallway smoking on Shabbos? I'm asking again. And the reason it doesn't upset us is all those reasons are good. But the real reason it doesn't upset us is because it doesn't upset us. You know?
There are people that won't get upset with either. It's even lower.
Okay.
But you're right. I mean, these for me to say, I've never seen that happening. So.
Oh, you can see. But it's not.
Just
a
second,
yet.
He's waiting.
A lot of the time in Tanakh, or from what I've read of Tanakh, the people seem very, very zealous.
For?
This seems like one of those times.
Right?
One person gets raped to death, and so far, 40,000 people die.
Right?
At one point, did they decide that this isn't worth it?
Let's go further. What was their goal in this war? You know, whenever you start a process, you have to ask yourself.
To prove a point. In my opinion. Well, I don't know. From what I know,
what's the point?
We're right. like there was a difference of opinion. Binyamin said A, and the rest of Israel said B, and it was, from what I think, just like an ego.
I'll tell you. I was once teaching in a place that hired a new CEO. So this guy comes in, it's his first week on the job, and he looks at their website, and he sees it's not succeeding. So he hires a company, and that company comes in and sees how to improve the website, and then they say, okay, such and such is what we need. He asks around, they tell him I have a website, so he asks me to come to the meeting where these consultants will discuss with us what needs to be done with the website. Okay, I have a little bit of experience, I agree. We come to the meeting, and they asked me what I thought of the website, and I explained to them where I thought the website could be improved. And then they spent 2 hours explaining to us how they could set it up so it could be improved. And then they said, we need someone who will invest time to deal with it on a weekly basis. So we end the meeting, and this new CEO says to me, okay, this is your job from now on. I said to him, you understand you're not talking about like 5 minutes a week, you're talking about between 4 and 10 hours a week. He said, yeah, that's your job from now on. I said to him, okay, and I quit. I'm not teaching here anymore. So he said to me, what happened? I said, go talk to the Rosh Yeshiva. I didn't come here to handle a website. I came here to teach Torah. You need someone to manage a website. Okay, that's not my job. That's not what I came for. That's what you want to switch my job for? You can do that, and I won't be here. So someone asked me, how could you tell him that on the spot? Didn't you think you have to think about it first? I said, no, because there are certain lines which when you cross those lines, then there's no point to everything we're doing here. If you tell me, look, I need you for an hour to help me, an hour a week, that's something I have to think about. It's not fair. It has nothing to do with what I'm supposed to be doing here. But I could hear, okay, maybe there's room to discuss it. You're going to switch 4 to 10 hours of my week to dealing with a website? No, not interested. There are other things I can do in life. I'm not, find someone else, goodbye. So it took me about 2 seconds. I said, no, goodbye. So he backed down, I never ended up dealing with their website. They hired someone else, which is what they should have done initially. But I didn't know this guy. He's new on the job. And here he's defining for me what I said, you didn't talk to the Rosh Yeshiva. But if you're the one who decides these things from now on, that's fine. You can decide, and I'm not here. There are certain things that you say, if I'm not going to stand up for this, then really everything I'm doing is worthless. And you have an example of that in the Torah. The Torah gives you mitzvos that are yehoreg val yavar. You have to be willing to give up your life for it. And there were years where I wondered, I not only wondered, I questioned whether I'd stand up to the time. They tell a person, bow down to that idol or die. So I always thought, like, what's the big deal? So you bow, okay? The Torah says, no, die. So Netanel Rengel always wondered, why? What's the big deal? And it's only after a period that I started appreciating it. It really struck me. I once saw, they wrote a story about a true story. It was some reporter was writing how in Africa, in order to break the morale of certain tribes, so there were warring tribes, and they kept trying to ensure that the regular villagers each would side with them. Each side wanted to ensure they sided with them. So one time, one side thought that the villagers had helped the other side. So they came into town. They surrounded everyone, brought everyone to the town square. And then they took the leader and told him that he now has to sleep with his sister in front of everyone. So they're standing there and they're telling him, there she is. They strip them both and they tell him, this is what you have to do right now. And they're standing there fully armed. And he looks at them and he says, no. And they lift an axe and they say, now or you're dead. And he says, no. And they cut off his head in front of everyone. And when I read that, I said to myself, that's probably the biggest Kiddush Hashem that I read, and that happened this year. I can't, what a Kiddush Hashem. Look at that. The man can stand there and say, what's the big deal? And everyone knows I'm forced. And he says, no. So I don't know this African. I don't know. I don't know where the tribe is. I don't know anything. But if it made it to the headlines on wherever it was, I looked at him and I said, wow, look, he actually left a message for the whole world. there are certain things that a human being should not cross those lines. And even if it means giving up your life for. So then I started thinking to myself, what a low life I am. I needed to read about an African in order to understand that there's such a thing as a Kiddush Hashem. Something you're willing to give up your life for. You know, that's exactly the idea the Torah gave us. The Torah says, no. There has to be a point where you say, I will give up my life and I will not give up my values. And for years I pondered, how come Avram was willing to go into the furnace? What would happen if Avram would say, okay, I'll bow? And it's harsher with regards to Avram for two reasons. Number one, God hasn't yet spoken to him. He's fighting a lone fight. You know, he says there is a God and he's alone. And number two, Avram could have justified to himself bowing to the idol, because if he's dead, who's going to promote the fight for monotheism? So he had every reason to say, I should give in. In the name of God, I should give in, right? Let me just bow, and then I'll be able to stick to my guns later. I'll find out a way how to do it. But Avram doesn't say that. So, again, it took me years to appreciate that there's a greatness in a person that says, these are my values, and these are my red lines where I will fight to the death for those red lines. And that's when you really instill values in yourself and in the world. So Avram could have justified doing other things, but he didn't. And the people of Israel could have said, is it worth 40,000 lives? She's dead. We're not going to bring her back with this fight. But we're going to ensure that this never happens again. We're going to ensure at least that we as a people have put out a real protest. When they let out the murderers last week, so guys asked me, what's the point of going? I said, look, Torah you have to learn, but the protest also has to happen. Because you can't have the state of Israel releasing terrorists that killed innocent civilians and the people sit back and say, well, there's no point in protesting. No, there has to be a public outcry, this is wrong. The fact that they're still going to do it, what can I do? I can't stop them. But if I'm silent, then I've become an accomplice. Silence is also a form of being an accomplice. And the greater the person, the greater the protest. When we go off the record, I'll tell you a few stories that you might not hear in public about great people of our day that made great protests and sat in jail. But not everything belongs on the mic.
I don't think this is the proper time, but just when it came to that protest, I never really understood why they were giving back the soldiers. People said the peace process, but...
Right. I don't either.
You don't have real freedom without that complete autonomy. I don't think if you wanted to do this, but, you know, as we talked about that once before, it's like you go home now.
So let's finish the book of Shoftim. So Am Yisrael decides that on this they're fighting and they're not giving in. And even though there are 40,000 soldiers dead, and going back to the point, what was their goal in this war? We're going to see their goal is to annihilate Benjamin. Meaning they're ready to kill tens of thousands of people over this act. It's a done deal. No. If they're not giving over the perpetrators, then it's not a done deal. And that's what they're saying. Then you're backing the perpetrators. And so Am Yisrael is told by Hashem, tomorrow you're going to win. So we think, okay, so let's sit back and drink coffee and shoot arrows into there. We'll win. God just said so, right? Now, you guys think that's funny, but I don't get it. People are contemplating, should I marry this girl? Should I not marry this girl? They go and they ask some guy they've never met before because he has a long white beard. And sometimes people just see someone in an ad in a newspaper and they go and ask him and then they make their life's decision and they don't do too much after that. Interesting, right? I don't know. Here, you had a real prophet. You had the Aaron. You had God telling them you're going to succeed. And the Navi makes a point of telling us they prepared an ambush and they prepared a second ambush and they prepared a whole plan as to how they'd win. They didn't sit back and said, God said so, it's going to work. No problem, right? Nope. They come the third day, and this time the trick is they're going to start the war, and then they're going to retreat. They're going to make it seem as though they're losing again. So they start retreating, and the tribe of Benjamin is sure that they're winning again. So they start chasing after them, and the ambush runs into the city. They have 10,000 people charging the city. The tribe of Benjamin turns around, they see their city going up in flames. Now the ambush comes out of the city, and the people of Israel do an about-face, and Benjamin is caught in between. 25,100 men are killed, soldiers. The people continue, they go into the city and destroy the city completely. And they surround Benjamin. They try to ensure that no one from Benjamin escapes. They chase him. And the next morning they get up and they come back to the city to destroy anyone left in the city. Men, women, children. They destroy the whole tribe. What's left is 600 people out in the desert. They've destroyed all of Benjamin except for 600 people. So they spend 6 months in the desert in hiding. And then Am Yisrael comes back and Am Yisrael is destroyed. So what did this cost us? 40 plus 26,000. That cost Am Yisrael 66,000 people. 40,000 of Israel, 26,000 from Benjamin. So, big war, civil war. That was just the men, right? That was just the men, plus women, plus children, right?
They can fight with the Philistine. They killed the Philistine, 100,000.
But you see here, they were fighting for a point. So they come back, and they erect an altar, which is interesting, because there was already an altar over there in Shiloh. So we see that the act of erecting an altar was also an act of, in some way, an act of prayer. And they wept, they offered sacrifices, they fasted. And then they said, let's do a check. Was there anyone who did not join the war? They had made a vow that anyone who did not join the war against Benjamin is obviously an accomplice to the crime, and they're going against them. So they discover that the people of Yavesh Gilad, that's all the way out on the eastern side of the Jordan, they did not join the attack against Benjamin. So they send 12,000 soldiers, and the 12,000 soldiers destroy all of Yavesh Gilad. Men, women, children, they kill everyone. They just tell them, when you find women who were never wed, women who are virgins, bring them back. So they bring back 400 young ladies, the rest they kill. And they say, okay, those women will be marriageable, they're suitable for the tribe of Benjamin. The people of Israel took a vow that no one's going to marry, no one's going to let their daughters marry into Benjamin. But these people of Yavesh Gilad, they weren't there, they didn't take the vow. So you have 400 girls that are shipped out to Benjamin for wives. And now they ask themselves, okay, what do we do for the remaining 200? You know, we want this tribe to come back. So they decide that we can't offer them the wives because we took a vow. But there's a party going on in Shiloh. Every year they'd go dancing around the vineyards, and whoever couldn't find the shidduch, the girls would go dancing there and the guys would come dancing there. And that was the place that the singles who couldn't find the shidduch the normal way would find the shidduch. So they told the tribe of Benjamin, the 200 of you who couldn't find a wife, you go out there. So among the remaining 200 men who didn't have a wife was a young man named Saul. You've heard of him, the first king of Israel. And now we understand that when God says the first king of Israel should come from the tribe of Benjamin, that was a revolution. Here the people had just fought this tribe. And a short time later, God says the first king is from them. He's the pious one. He's the one who's fitting. So one of the young men that goes out to the vineyard is Saul. And he's too bashful to pick up a wife. So there was a girl there that had a little bit of spunk, and she ran up to him and grabbed him. So at any rate, that's how King Saul got married here in this story. And later on, later in King Saul's life, he's going to talk about her and her son. You have your mother's rebellious streak in you. Even though they got married that way. But you see, when she offered him, I know couples that do this too. I once accompanied a couple where she offered him to get married. You know, she proposed to him. Okay, if it's good for him and good for her, I'm not going to get in between. They're married, they're happily married with kids. So at any rate, the solution is this way: if the tribes come complaining, the tribe of Benjamin took our daughters, so the answer is, you took a vow, you would not give your daughters as wife. Here you didn't give them over, the tribe of Benjamin took, you didn't give them over, and we'll placate them to ensure that you guys have a continuation, and that's what happens. So the tribe of Benjamin is reestablished, and Israel is reunited, and the Navi concludes, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every person did what was right in their eyes, And here we see how great the people of Israel were, that even without a king, the people of Israel could unite and say, we abolish evil from our midst. And that leads us to the book of Shmuel. Shmuel wrote the book of Shoftim, and his book, the book of Shmuel, in Jewish tradition, it's one book of Shmuel. This A and B is a Christian invention. So in the book of Shmuel, we begin our story with a man named Elkanah, who has two wives, Hannah and Pnina. And Elkanah is the leader of the Jewish people who travels throughout Israel to educate the people. And his wife Pnina has seven children. And his wife Hannah has no children. And Elkanah is a descendant of Korach. Elkanah is a Levite. Elkanah comes from the mountainous regions of Har Ephraim. And so Elkanah is traveling every year to bring the sacrifices, and every year he gives his wife Pnina some good food, and Hannah he gives even better food, because poor Hannah has no children. And as much as Elkanah tries to calm Hannah down, Hannah is always upset, because Pnina, the other wife who has so many children, is always teasing her. Did you see they have a sale on kids' clothing? Oh, I forgot, you don't have kids. Every time she'd say a line like that, and her intention was to help Hannah in her prayer, but she did it in a way that was cruel, even though her intentions were for good, so that Hannah would pray more fervently, but the action, nonetheless, was cruel. And so in heaven, that was held against Pnina, and Elkanah would always try to placate Hannah, but it didn't work until the one time, which is where we'll pick up his Hashem next week.